Today is Tuesday, May 4th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, over 25 people killed in a metro bridge collapse in Mexico.
The overpass is 16 feet above the road. The train split in two with one part left dangling off the overpass.
Plus, President Biden faces obstacles to his $4 trillion legislation.
That massive bill rebuilding American roads and bridges, boosting internet broadband, already drawing Republican criticism.
Also, COVID cases and deaths continue to surge in India. These stories and more are next. More than 25 people are dead and over 70 injured in Mexico after an elevated section of the city's metro rail system collapsed Monday night. The mayor says a support beam gave way, sending a subway car plunging towards a busy boulevard. AP correspondent Judy Walker reports.
Mayor Claudia Sheinbaum says a support beam gave way just as the train passed over it. The overpass is 16 feet above the road. The train split in two with one part left dangling off the overpass, a crane holding it up, the other part of the subway under rubble on the roadway, along with at least one car. The mayor told the news media at the scene people could still be trapped inside. Hundreds of rescuers were working at the scene. She says some of those killed were children. And at least seven of the injured were in serious condition, with another 49 taken to the hospital. I'm Julie Walker.
With the first 100 days of his presidency now behind him, U.S. President Joe Biden faces formidable battles to pass the rest of his legislative agenda on Capitol Hill. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the obstacles Democrats face to pass nearly $4 trillion in legislation.
President Biden promoting his $2.7 trillion American Jobs Plan, first on a list of ambitious proposals up for debate in the U.S. Congress in coming weeks.
Doing nothing is not an option.
That massive bill rebuilding American roads and bridges, boosting internet broadband, and providing clean drinking water, already drawing Republican criticism. Republican Senator John Kennedy.
He clearly believes that he can tax, spend, and regulate our country into prosperity.
A battle that will consume attention on Capitol Hill this month. George Washington University legislative affairs analyst Casey Burgat.
Things like police reform bill and gun control and immigration, those, in my estimation, are probably going to be kicked to the side right now, with a focus to be on the American Family Plan and the infrastructure bill, knowing that they can get a lot done within those two huge pieces of legislation.
Biden issued a challenge to lawmakers to revisit police reform. A similar proposal failed to pass the U.S. Senate last summer amid protests over the death of George Floyd.
We have to come together to rebuild trust between law enforcement and the people they serve. Let's get it done next month. By the first anniversary of George Floyd's death.
Democrats also introduced a sweeping immigration reform proposal earlier this year that will likely only pass in smaller pieces given the political challenges.
For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it.
The chief obstacle to all of these proposals, the filibuster, a 60-vote threshold in the U.S. Senate that will block all but the most bipartisan of proposals. Brookings Institution governance analyst Molly Reynolds.
They are really constrained by the filibuster. But at the end of the day, the question is as much, do they have the votes in their own party to make a change to the filibuster to get some of these things done?
This summer presents the best opportunity for Biden and Democrats to pass their proposals before Capitol Hill's attention turns to passing a government budget and then midterm elections next year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Senate Republican leaders say the party is open to spending $600 billion for infrastructure improvements. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is floating a national infrastructure investment spending plan that's about a quarter the size of the $2.3 trillion proposal President Joe Biden has laid out. Speaking at the University of Louisville Monday, McConnell said Republicans are willing to spend up to $600 billion on infrastructure. McConnell also came out against Biden's plan to pay for the infrastructure package by raising the corporate tax rate from 21% back to 28%. Instead, McConnell said he favors favors increasing user fees. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. President Biden on Tuesday will update the country on how it is faring in the battle against COVID-19 and the effort to get more Americans vaccinated against the coronavirus. The latest from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
The president, following remarks on Monday afternoon at a community college in Virginia, was asked by a reporter when the country will reach herd immunity, meaning when will a sufficient percentage of the population be immune to the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 because of previous exposure or inoculation.
There's a debate into what constitutes herd immunity. Is it 70% of the population? Is it 68%? Is it 81%?
No matter the precise percentage, Biden says he thinks by the end of the summer we'll be in a very different position. And what is critical now, according to the president, is for everyone to get vaccinated. Steve Herman, VOA News at the White House.
India has reported more than 300,000 new coronavirus infections for a 12th straight day on Monday to take its overall number of cases to just shy of 20 million. To learn more about the spread of COVID-19 there, and what's been done to curb it, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with reporter Anjana Patricia in Mumbai.
Officials have attributed the second wave to the public abandoning COVID protocols, such as wearing masks and social distancing, after there was a lull in infections earlier in the year. Public health experts, however, also point the finger at the government for allowing super spreader events such as packed political rallies for state elections and a Hindu religious festival that saw millions congregate last month. They say policymakers also became complacent along with the public because they believed the virus was in retreat and did not pay sufficient attention when cases began rising. But on the ground, dire shortages persist.
Anjana, I wanted to ask you about vaccine adoption in India because it's home to the Serum Institute, which is the largest manufacturer of vaccines in the world. But India has a woefully low number of inoculations.
Well, the problem is that the vaccination program has been riddled with shortages in recent weeks because authorities never anticipated the massive demand once the second wave came. And they believed that the virus was in retreat so that they could go ahead with this kind of slow, measured program. It was also relying mainly on vaccines produced domestically. But according to health experts, steps were not taken earlier on to ramp up manufacturing or stockpile enough doses. I mean, it's a country of 1.4 billion people, so you know you need millions and millions of doses. For months, the program has moved at a sluggish pace. Only 2% have been fully vaccinated and about 10% have got one dose. India even sent vaccines to 80 countries earlier in the year as part of its push for what is called vaccine diplomacy. Of course, since then, authorities have suspended exports, allotted funds to two companies to expand production, and approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, which will be produced in the country. But you know, all this is now going to take time. And meanwhile, it has opened the program to all adults above 18. But as I said, there are no stockpiles now.
That's reporter Anjana Patricia speaking with my colleague Steve Miller from Mumbai, India. Rights groups and opposition politicians criticized Australia's new ban on citizens returning from coronavirus-hit India. From Monday, Australia started implementing a law that would land its citizens and permanent residents up to 5 years in jail and a fine of up to $50,000 if they tried to enter Australia from India. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The government has said the ban aims to protect Australia's hotel quarantine system for returned travellers. Officials have said more than half of recent COVID-19 infections detected in isolation hotels were linked to travellers arriving from India. Senior ministers say the law isn't racist and that this is a public health issue, while some immigrants in the country say it unfairly targets permanent residents and citizens who happen to be immigrants from India. Siddhi Gupta from Melbourne is one of thousands of Australians stranded in India. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that she feels abandoned and expressed the anguish she's experiencing due to separation from her children.
My mind is completely stuck in thinking, how will I be able to go back? Whenever I talk to my children, it's so disheartening to hear from them. When are you coming back, Mama?
Critics say the latest legal measures go a bit too far, citing parallel measures taken during earlier coronavirus surges in other countries. They say people travelling from Europe or the United States weren't met with similar measures. The new ban and punishment, some experts say, is illegal and breaches laws enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 13 in the Declaration states that individuals have the right to leave and return to their own country. Health Minister Greg Hunt said the ban announced on Saturday would be reconsidered on May 15. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison again defended the restrictions.
This is a way to ensure that we can prevent the virus coming back and starting a third wave here in Australia that would have devastating impacts on our country. We're going to keep bringing back people safely from India, but we have to do it in a way that won't subject the rest of the country to seeing a third wave of COVID. It's a temporary measure.
A poll released Monday by the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research body, has shown broad support for Australia's hardline approach to containing the spread of the virus. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The US Food and Drug Administration is expected to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 12 to 15 by next week, setting up shots for many before the beginning of the new school year. That's according to a federal official and a person familiar with the process. The FDA action will be followed by a meeting of a federal vaccine advisory committee to discuss whether to recommend the shots for 12 to 15-year-olds. Then, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention would act on the committee's recommendation. Those steps could be completed in a matter of days. Foreign ministers representing a group of seven industrialized nations are holding meetings Tuesday in London, discussing a range of world issues, including relations with China and Russia, the coup in Myanmar, the Syrian conflict, and the situation in Afghanistan. Britain's Foreign Office said in Tuesday's session, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab will lead discussions on pressing geopolitical issues that threaten to undermine democracy, freedoms, and human rights. G7 members are expected to sanction individuals and entities connected to Myanmar's military junta, to support arms embargoes, and to boost humanitarian aid to the people of Myanmar. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken called for an end to violence and a return to democratic rule.
Five-point plan or agreement that ASEAN reached, I think, is important, and we are looking to ASEAN to move forward with that plan, including designating an envoy from Myanmar and getting that person to Myanmar to be able to engage all of the parties. But it is vital, regardless of anything else, that the violence cease, that prisoners be released, and that Myanmar return to the path of democracy.
On ties with Russia, Blinken said the U.S. wants a more stable relationship, but much will depend on how aggressively the Kremlin decides to act.
We are focused very much on Russia's actions and what course it chooses to take. President Biden's been very clear for a long time, including before he was president, that if Russia chooses to act recklessly or aggressively, we'll respond. But we're not looking to escalate. We would prefer to have a more stable, more predictable relationship.
In Afghanistan, as U.S. forces draw down amid fears of Taliban and al-Qaeda attacks, Blinken said the administration is very focused on a deliberate, safe and orderly withdrawal of forces from Afghanistan.
We are very focused on a deliberate, safe and orderly drawdown of our forces. We've made absolutely clear that as we withdraw forces from Afghanistan, we will protect them. And if they are attacked, we will take decisive action in response. But we've also been clear that even as our forces are drawing down and pulling out of Afghanistan, we are not withdrawing. We are not disengaging. We intend to be very active diplomatically in terms of trying to advance negotiations and a political settlement between the government of Afghanistan, the Taliban, and other key parties.
Thus, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, Tuesday's meeting comes in preparation for the G7's Leaders' Summit, scheduled to take place in June, also in Britain. This is the Voice of America. Police in Berlin have arrested a 53-year-old German man on suspicion of sending dozens of threatening letters to politicians, lawyers, and journalists that were signed with the acronym of a far-right extremist group. Prosecutors in Frankfurt said early Tuesday that the man was detained in the German capital on Monday. They said the suspect had previous convictions for, quote, numerous crimes, including ones that were motivated by right-wing ideology, unquote. Lebanon and Israel have resumed indirect talks with the U.S. mediation over their disputed maritime border after nearly a six-month pause. Tuesday's resumption of the talks comes after the Biden administration has taken over and as Lebanon has sunk deeper in economic crisis. The resolution of the crisis could pave the way for lucrative oil and gas deals for Lebanon. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, said Tuesday the government was working on, quote, fake news, unquote, legislation to tackle, quote, misinformation, hatred and lies, unquote, as worries grow over media freedoms in a global financial hub. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam said on Tuesday the government was working on a fake news law. The legislation will tackle misinformation, hatred and lies.
We have no timetable.
Speaking at the weekly press conference, Lam gave no timeline for the drafting process, but said the government was looking into other countries' approaches.
The fake news law needs a lot of research, especially how overseas governments are tackling this increasingly worrying trend of spreading inaccurate information.
But the announcement has been met with concern that this may be the latest turning of the screws, cracking down on media freedom in the global financial hub. This week, Hong Kong broadcaster RTHK announced reporter Nabella Kosa, known for her hard-hitting questions for Lam, would not have her contract renewed. The network also began removing some of its archives from its YouTube and social media channels, prompting online activists to quickly back up the content. Last month, RTHK journalist Bao Choi was found guilty on improperly accessing public records when investigating a mob attack on pro-democracy protesters in 2019. The case has fueled concern in Hong Kong, which has become increasingly authoritarian after a sweeping national security law imposed last year.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. On Wednesday, France's lower house is expected to approve a bill aimed at drastically cutting the country's greenhouse gas emissions. The bill is a backdrop by bleak new findings of a rapidly warming Europe. But Lisa Bryan reports from Paris that the bill faces sharp criticism by green and industry groups alike.
Polls find many French citizens support the spirit of the massive legislation, which aims to meet the country's goal of cutting greenhouse gases by 40% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. A recent report by the EU's climate service found 2020 was Europe's hottest year on record, and the region was warming faster than the rest of the world. The French bill's dozens of measures include limiting the most polluting vehicles in urban areas, slapping eco-taxes on truck transport, banning heated restaurant terraces, and capping rent on insulated housing. The National Assembly is expected to pass the legislation before it heads to the Senate. But the bill is deeply controversial, with industry saying it's too constraining and green groups saying it doesn't go far enough. Chloé Gerbier, legal officer for environmental NGO Notre Affaire à Tous, says the legislation in no way meets the urgency of the climate crisis. She and others say it drastically waters down proposals made by a citizens' climate convention set up by President Emmanuel Macron. Earlier wording in the bill, for example, that made serious environmental abuses a crime, now tags them as lesser misdemeanors. Green groups also want a bigger category of short-haul domestic flights banned in favor of train transport. France's airline industry, hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic, doesn't want any flight bans. Nicolas Polissen, managing director of the Union of French Airports, says it doesn't make sense to penalize French airlines when much of the industry's growth is happening in Africa and Asia.
We do rather believe in the greening of the aviation through technological innovation, for instance. And that's why we encourage the French government to finance the research for new technologies, allowing the aviation to be greener in the next future.
Pompidi acknowledges a slew of criticism, but says the legislation is balancing sharply opposing interests to bring everyone on board. Earlier this year, a Paris court convicted the French state of failing to address the climate crisis and for not keeping its promises to tackle greenhouse emissions. The government is appealing the ruling. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Biden administration officials say they are serious about global climate change and that they are demonstrating their intent with an initiative that funds projects across the African continent. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Climate change, poverty, and economic growth. These three indicators, the U.S. leadership says, are inextricably linked in the fight against environmental degradation in the developing world. But to make change happen, they need money. Enter the Millennium Challenge Corporation, an independent U.S. agency that gives out big grants to modernize infrastructure, address policy reforms, and promote growth in sectors that affect everyone in the economy, from the youngest child to the most ambitious entrepreneur. Acting CEO Mahmoud Ba explained in a call with journalists on Monday.
These grants are large, multi-year, and predictable. These are not loans, and they do not add to the country's debt burden. Our compacts tend to pair large investments in infrastructure in sectors like water, energy, agriculture, with institutional and policy reforms that ensure those investments have a significant and sustainable impact.
What that looks like on the ground, he explained, is this. Hundreds of millions of dollars poured into developing nations, most of them African, for hydropower projects, agricultural improvements, better access to electricity, and land reform. Neither Ba nor his deputy, Alexia Latortue, explicitly mentioned China, which is rapidly rolling out development across Africa through an ambitious infrastructure project known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Latortue sought to distinguish the American way of doing business.
MPC's three strategic priorities are inclusion and gender, catalyzing the private sector, and thirdly, climate. And if there's one takeaway I have for you, is that the three priorities are all about helping to achieve high-quality growth.
And she said the U.S. has proven this commitment.
So MCC recognizes that climate change is absolutely linked to poverty and economic growth. Indeed, MCC was an early leader in fighting climate change in developing countries, investing in the past 5 years alone over $1.5 billion, which is about 38% of our program of funds in climate-related activities. Our climate work covers adaptation, climate resilience, and mitigation.
To that end, she said, the corporation has made a new goal. More than half of their funds in the next 5 years will be used for climate change work around the world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ultrasound technology provides a crucial window into patients' health, but is often inaccessible in developing countries. Now a handheld ultrasound device could be a game changer for the developing world, as Tina Trent reports.
In Nairobi, Kenya, this expectant mother is getting a glimpse of the future, courtesy of a device called the Butterfly IQ.
Butterfly IQ is the world's first single-probe, whole-body ultrasound system.
The $2,000 handheld ultrasound device works with both iOS and Android mobile devices to provide medical imaging in real time. John Martin is chief medical officer for Butterfly.
So instead of being sent off for a test, you pull a test right out of the pocket.
Butterfly was one of 17 digital health winners in the Global Tech Challenge, an initiative between the World Bank Group and the Consumer Technology Association. This year's challenge focused on solutions for improving healthcare access in East Africa.
Our model before Butterfly is we had one ultrasound, and this was something that would actually move in a taxi from clinic to clinic.
Melissa Menke is the founder of Access Afia, a network of healthcare clinics within the informal settlements of Nairobi that began testing Butterfly IQ last fall. Menke says Butterfly IQ's teleguidance feature is a game changer.
Where a woman can sit with a clinical officer, this is more of a junior doctor, and he or she can hold the probe, provide the service. Our expert on the other end can draw on the image, can circle things, can say, do you see this?
Menke says the device has allowed frontline staff to do more, but admits there is a learning curve. The need is urgent in Kenya, where high maternal mortality rates still plague mothers-to-be. Tina Trin, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.